This episode contains discussion of graphic violence and murder. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. Edgefield is a town and a county in South Carolina, in what's considered the Augusta metropolitan area. You may know that Augusta is one of those cities that stretches over two states, the southern part in Georgia and the northern portion in South Carolina. Edgefield isn't far from Aiken, South Carolina either, maybe 30 minutes or so. Just in that area, Augusta, Aiken, Edgefield, and the tiny towns in between, there are so many cases we've covered or mentioned on the show. The disappearance of the Millbrook twins, the unidentified Aiken County Jane Does, the murders of Moses Williams Jr. and Tiffany Nelson. Edgefield is split neatly by the Fall Line, with the Piedmont on one side and the Sandhill and Ridge on the other. According to its official website, the town is home to nearly 5,000 and was primarily built on agriculture and manufacturing, industries that are still important to the town today. Edgefield's historic sectors are better preserved than most you'll find in the southeast. Buildings dating back to the 18th century still stand there. History is a big selling point, at least according to Edgefield's tourist literature. Major events and figures are covered in detail, from the story of a famous murderer in the 18th century, Betty Cotton, to the 10 South Carolina governors who lived in the town. More than any other can claim. But Edgefield is not a town that stopped in time. It's the seat of the county, and though the population in the city limits is small, there are more people scattered throughout its unincorporated areas. There's farmland, and there's a federal prison that sits along the line that separates the town from the outer reaches of the county. It's also called Edgefield. In some places in the South, you say that name, and people assume you mean the correctional facility. Sometimes they forget there's a town, too, gathered at the prison's border. But Edgefield needs to be remembered. There are stories there, now, not from the long ago past, that are in desperate need of attention. Like a break-in that happened in the neighborhood of Merriweather back in July of 2010 at a home rented by a young couple. If it was a planned robbery, it was a strange one. Both residents were home. One intruder entered through the front door and one through the back. Larry Sanders Jr., who was called LJ by friends and family, was shot in the chest. He died at the scene. When we covered the murder of Moses Williams Jr. on the podcast in January of 2022, we spoke about a vigil that Moses' mother, Tamika, attended. It was one of the many events that she would go to. But this particular one was special. It took place in August of 2013. And it was held on what would have been the birthday weekend of her son, who was murdered in February of 2012. There was another mother there, Carolyn Bates, who spoke to reporters. She said, quote, "There's one thing that Tamika and myself share, the sadness that goes along with having to bury a child." Carolyn Bates is LJ's mother. By the time Moses was murdered, she'd been seeking justice for her own son for more than a year. LJ was just 28 years old when he was killed. He was the father of two daughters, both only 4 years old when he was murdered. They weren't the only people he left behind. His brother, Dewan, his father and stepmother, his stepfather, step-siblings, grandparents, and his mother, Carolyn, who was there for Moses' vigil. She'd gotten used to memorials. She's been attending them, organizing them, and holding her own for a decade. Since her firstborn was killed, and no one could tell her why. We met Carolyn Bates in March of 2022. That's when our friend and colleague, Renetta DeBose, hosted a luncheon for all the families whose stories she'd covered on her special in-depth investigative series, Cold Case Project. We've done an episode on Renetta's work on Cold Case Project, and we hope you'll check it out if you haven't listened. She began her work on unsolved cases because of her own grandmother's cold case homicide. A number of family members that you've gotten to know well were in attendance that day. Donna Green, the mother of Raymond Green, who was kidnapped from Grady in 1978. Shante Sturgis and her mother, Louise Sturgis, the sister and mother of Jeanette and Danette Millbrook, whose story began the fall line. We were seated with Carolyn at the event. At the time, she was only a few months away from the 12th anniversary of LJ's murder. Renetta had recently featured his story on WJBF in hopes of bringing forth new leads in his case. The new Edgefield County Sheriff, Jody Rowland, had agreed to interview for Renetta's piece. As with all of Renetta's work, it was in-depth coverage. She and Carolyn hoped that it would bring in tips. But now it's November, and the anniversary has passed, and Carolyn is still waiting. When we exchanged contact information at that event, we spoke about getting LJ's story in front of a new audience, our audience, in hopes that it could be circulated more widely. Maybe the right person will hear this episode or see a posting on social media and offer up a piece of information that can move things forward. Midlands Crime Stoppers offers up to $1,000 reward for tips leading to an arrest. We'll give you that number at the end of the show. Share it if you can, because Carolyn and her remaining son and the rest of the family, they need to know who, and they need to know why. When we spoke with Carolyn this fall, she told us a little bit about their family history and LJ's early life.
Well, I was born and raised in Chicago, born into a family of eight, three girls and five brothers, mother and father in the household. And I had a very good childhood. I was the middle child. I was actually the fifth child. My household was very structured. You know, whatever mom and dad said, that's what we did. Of course, you know, being kids, you know, what child is not mischievous? But as far as like, you know, really getting into, I'll say, major trouble, that did not occur because we know that there would be a consequence. So, and even today, you know, me and my siblings are very close. Since then, our parents have passed and our older sister, she's passed. And so now it's just seven of us.
So once you became a mom yourself, would you say that you had had a lot of experience caring for your younger siblings?
Indeed. even the older siblings, I don't know. And it just happened that way. It was like I, you know, learned how to cook at 13, washing the clothes and, you know, cleaning the house. And if mom and dad needed something done, they just always called on me. I was 19 when I got pregnant with LJ. And at that, well, me and his dad were not married, but we ended up getting married. It just seemed like it was the thing to do. You know, you get pregnant, you're not married, you get married. And so I think I was more scared and concerned about the repercussions from getting pregnant and not married. So I was more concerned about, you know, oh my Lord, what is my dad going to do? You know, what is mom going to say? You know, but as far as being a mother, I never doubted that I would be a good mother, just like I never doubted that I would be a good wife, because I had a good example in my mother, who was an excellent mother. She was a great disciplinarian as well. And so those were traits that, I don't know, they were just like in me, I guess you can say. But, you know, of course it was, you know, it wasn't easy, you know, being a young mother, because at that time, you know, you really don't know who you are as an individual. It really was not a great marriage. But we did stay married for 12 years, and not to, you know, jump too far ahead, but we ended up having another son, LJ's youngest brother, 4 years later. But it was, the marriage itself was rocky, but LJ was a really, really, really good baby. I want to say when he turned like maybe four, his inner self started kind of coming out, and LJ, I've often said that, you know, he had this attitude that I'm going to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, how I want to do it. If I don't want to do it, I'm not going to do it. So me being the structured or I don't want to say strict parent, but just structured parent. It, you know, of course, made it a little difficult, especially the older he got, because it's like, okay, you know, if you're going to be in my house, these are the rules. But he, you know, he was a loyal friend. He was definitely a good loyal brother. Him and his brother, they really had a good relationship. I can only remember one time where it may have gotten, I'll say, physical with them, because they know that was something that was not allowed. You don't fight your brother. But yeah, LJ was, he just had that mentality that I'm going to do what I want to do. And so, of course, that caused conflict and friction. And although it was a power struggle, I knew I had to stand my ground. You know, I knew that I had to, no matter what he was trying to do, I had to let him know that this is not how it works. When he was like 13, I sent him to go live with his dad, and because by that time, him and me and his father were divorced. And so I sent him to go live with his dad and his stepmother, and that was not that great either. He really didn't like school. And so I want to say when he was like 16 or 17, he was still a freshman. He may have been a sophomore, but I'm really thinking he was a freshman at 16 or 17. And so I had made the decision to go ahead on and just take him out of school because I was just like, why am I still wasting my time? Because, you know, of course, if he does something in school, they're calling me, and then I'm having to go up to the school for parent-teacher conferences or whatever, or he's getting suspended. So I just finally decided to take him on out of school. But he did go and get his GED, and I was very proud of him, you know, accomplishing that.
Can you tell me, what did he not like about school?
I'm thinking that it could have been, and this is just really a guess, just the structuredness of school, you know, having to be there with teachers and, you know, because he was like considered like the class clown when he did go. He just wasn't into school, especially when he got to high school, because then you're able to really kind of cut classes. And, you know, this was like kind of before the automated system, you know, your child did not show up in school today.
Mm-hmm.
That's my guess, is that he just really didn't like the structure and just didn't care for school.
It's not that LJ was disinterested in learning. According to his family interviews with Renetta, he was fascinated with engineering and mechanics and doing things with his hands. As Carolyn told us, he eventually expressed an interest in pursuing a career in underwater welding. He just didn't like the constraints of school. That seemed to be a theme with LJ. He liked doing things his own way and learning through experience. And when it came to his teenage years, Carolyn continued to face some challenges, at least for a while.
I want to say, I'm not exactly sure when started living that street life, as far as, you know, making that easy money or, you know, selling drugs or being involved in gangs. I'm not exactly sure when that started, but I do know when it was in the early, I want to say it was 2000, he might have been 18.
That period of time that Carolyn mentioned, it ended up being a major turning point for LJ. In the fall of 2000, he almost died. Two of his friends, they did die. Within the year, he'd find himself one of two survivors on a witness stand at a murder trial. LJ had just turned 19 in November of 2000. It was Thanksgiving break and plenty of college kids were in the Augusta metro area, home for the holiday. LJ's friend, 18-year-old Natika Wesby, was one of them. According to the Augusta Chronicle, Natika was a freshman at Valdosta State. While in town, she was hanging out at the Augusta, Georgia apartment complex, Westwood Village, where a third friend, Corey McMillan, also 18, lived. On November 24, 2000, LJ and his girlfriend at the time, 18-year-old Monique Hicks, went to Westwood Village to visit. LJ and Corey were friends, and the couple wanted to see Natika before she headed back to school. According to the Augusta Chronicle, LJ and Corey were engaged in a dispute with a mutual acquaintance, 17-year-old Marcus Moore. According to later trial testimony, as reported by the Chronicle, Marcus Moore had loaned LJ and Corey two notebooks, and he wanted them back. Per the Chronicle, quote, Mr. Moore had loaned notebooks containing the rules for the Folk Nation Gang, also known as the Black Gangster Disciples, to Mr. Sanders and Mr. McMillan. On Thanksgiving Day, Mr. Moore telephoned and demanded their return, end quote. LJ later testified that, quote, he and Corey McMillan, 18, had been gang members, but had not been involved with it for some time. LJ told the court that he couldn't even understand the symbols contained in the notebook or notebooks. It's unclear, based on coverage of the events, whether there were actually one or two notebooks, and why Marcus Moore got upset with them after he loaned them out. Perhaps he feared others would discover he was sharing that information. Some reports claim that Marcus was angry that he only received one notebook back. Other articles implied that the loaning itself was the issue. What we do know is this. On November 24, 2000, the Chronicle reported that Marcus arranged for a ride to West Manor Village. LJ, Monique, Natika, and Corey were all there. Monique would later describe what happened when Marcus came to the door. As the Chronicle reported, Monique Hicks testified, quote, the person at the door was saying he wanted his stuff and that he wanted it now. She said that LJ and Marcus, who she did know, had a disagreement, but described it as follows. Quote, it wasn't a fight. That's the wrong word. They were just arguing. It was just words. But then, according to Monique, quote, he pulled out a gun and he shot Mr. Sanders. Corey was trying to run and he hit Corey and he fell. Corey wasn't the only one who fell. Natika attempted to flee, but was also hit. LJ had been shot too, in the throat. Monique, the only one of the four who was uninjured, called 911. The recording captured her trying to tend to all three of her friends at once. The Chronicle reported that Natika died at the scene. Corey would make it to the hospital, but he passed away there. LJ was in critical condition, but survived. In 2001, he and Monique testified at Marcus Moore's murder trial. Marcus was 17 when the killings occurred, but 18 when he was brought to trial. Prosecutors originally sought the death penalty. He eventually pled guilty in exchange for life without parole. That agreement included waiving his right to appeal. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, Marcus filed a motion in 2010 based on the 2005 Supreme Court ruling that barred juvenile death sentences. The argument made was that, as of 2001, quote, the state could seek a life without parole sentence only in cases where the state could legally impose the death penalty. The court found that Roper applies retroactively to vacate death sentences imposed on juveniles. The Georgia Supreme Court agreed that Marcus had not waived his right to appeal and that he should be resentenced. That was the news in 2013. As of 2022, Marcus Moore is still in prison. Though there are active motions on his case as recently as October of 2022. As you might imagine, 2001 was a terrifying time in LJ's life and his family's. He was dealing not only with his injury, but the death of his friends, and later testifying in court at a murder trial.
When that occurred, I was like, okay, especially after he survived, I was like, okay, this has to be the turning point. This has to be where, you know, he turned his life around. Not to jump too far ahead, he did end up signing up for school at Aiken Tech. And he wanted to be an underwater welder. I really think it was because he wanted to get out of that lifestyle that he was in. And he liked nice things. So he knew whatever job that he was going to do, I'll say after that lifestyle, he was going to have to be making a decent salary. And I really believe that was, I'll say, one of the reasons that he, you know, chose that lifestyle. And I think, too, he would have been, you know, using his hands. And I think, you know, just the excitement of being able to do such a job or have such a career would have been rewarding to him and for him. But yeah, that's what he wanted to do. And he was in school to do that.
It also sounds like it kind of has an element of like excitement and kind of danger. Do you think that sort of fit his personality?
Indeed. Yeah, definitely spot on. But I will say too, the danger part of it. I think he realized that street danger definitely was not, you know, going to be a great way for him to live, because now he has two daughters. Mm-hmm. He was setting himself up to get out of that lifestyle for his daughters.
Tell me about the arrival of his daughters.
Very interesting. Because they're 4 months apart. Yes, it was very, very interesting. And by that time, I'll say this too. I want to say when the first baby arrived, the oldest one, I want to say he was having some substance abuse issues. But he was there for the birth of both of his children. Again, it was, you know, it was interesting because October, we delivered the first baby. And then February, we're back in there again delivering the second child. And like I told both of the mothers, and I told LJ, you know, in a really nice way, you know, I love you guys, but I don't care about you guys. All I know is these babies better know that they're sisters. And that was my concern, because they did not ask to be, you know, brought up in this situation 4 months apart, you know, two different mothers. But they know that they're sisters. They have a relationship. LJ had a relationship with, you know, both of his daughters. At some point, the mothers, you know, developed a relationship to raise these two girls, you know, that were sisters.
Where LJ was in life in July of 2010 is a complex knot to unravel. He was in school at Aiken Tech, pursuing his passion for welding, and he was in a long-term relationship. He had a good relationship with his family. And when LJ's loved one spoke with Renetta for her Cold Case Project Spotlight, everyone underlined one particular fact. LJ was an excellent father. His daughters were born when he was in his early 20s, and he put a lot of energy into their care. Carolyn told Renetta, quote, "He changed. He matured. Started being more responsible. Our relationship was just so much better, because I think he was able to relate to being a parent." But according to Carolyn and to law enforcement investigation, LJ may have been involved in narcotic sales at the time of his death. This involvement seems to point to some of the events that occurred leading up to his death and the deadly shooting at his home. In the late 2000s, Carolyn had moved back to Chicago for a time, but was back in the Southeast by December of 2009. That meant she was in the North Augusta metro area when a concerning incident occurred. It was a break-in at LJ's then apartment in the Chalet North Court Apartments in North Augusta. When Renetta DeBose interviewed LJ's brother, Dewan, he told her, quote, "Somebody tried to break into the apartment, and so he moved out. He stayed in a hotel for a week or two until he found another house to move to. He moved to that house. Things were quiet for a minute, and I heard there were a few situations where him and someone didn't get along." According to Renetta's reporting, LJ did not report the break-in to police, so we don't have a record of what, if anything, was taken. We do know that based on Dewan's statements to her, LJ was not easily frightened. but felt it was best to move himself and his girlfriend to a new home. After all, his children would often visit the home too. We don't know specifically with whom he wasn't getting along, but LJ's family has spoken with law enforcement on numerous occasions. They've told the sheriff and the State Bureau everything they know. LJ and his girlfriend hadn't lived in the new place on Eagle Road in Edgefield for long when the second deadly break-in occurred.
I really was not planning on moving back until July 2010, but my mother was in a car accident and I came back early. I came back in December 2009, again, not knowing that LJ was going to be murdered the same month that I would have been trying to get back here anyway, but that's how he works. So, but when I moved back in December 2009, by that time, LJ was in Edgefield County at the Eagle Road address where he was murdered. That night, I had actually went out with a friend, and when I got the call, it wasn't too far after midnight. Dewan was on the phone crying, saying that LJ got shot and that he was dead. Just reflecting back, I just heard shot. I don't think I wanted to hear dead. Of course, you know, now, you know, I'm on my way out to his house and I called my sister so she could meet me out there. And so when I pulled up, well, no, let me go back. So on the way there, I called my son again just to see, you know, what was going on. He reminded me again. No, I think I asked, had the ambulance been called? And he said, no, Mom. He said, I told you that, you know, that he's dead. And so that's when I one thing I could remember just saying over and over and over, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead. Because I think I was just trying to just make sense of what I heard and what I was saying. And so I could just remember screaming, you know, and just crying, because then it registered that he was dead. I could remember speaking to his girlfriend who was in the house, and she was, you know, telling us what had happened. And I could remember just, you know, starting to cry again. And I could remember the Lord telling me that LJ is okay and that he's with me, that, again, that he's okay and that, you know, to trust him.
LJ's girlfriend was unharmed, but was unable to offer Carolyn or investigators any detailed descriptions of the shooters. Recently, we spoke with Edgefield County Sheriff Jody Rowland about LJ's case. He wasn't sheriff in 2010, when both Edgefield County and SLED, the South Carolina State Investigative Bureau, became involved in LJ's open homicide investigation. But he is familiar with LJ's file and walked us through some of the early law enforcement activity regarding LJ's murder.
Can you describe what officers found when they arrived at the scene?
Once they secured the outside of the residence, they went in and found Mr. Sanders and his girlfriend in the bedroom of the home. Mr. Sanders was dead. The girlfriend was a lot of blood on the scene, and she had attempted CPR, and that was basically it.
It seems like interviews were a really big part of this case. Is that are those the primary steps that were taken early on in the investigation?
Yeah, I think so. Early on, I think the sheriff's office did a poor job of the crime scene itself, but the follow up took a lot more time than it should have. However, not blaming the sheriff's office, but once Led was called in and they teamed up, a lot of interviews were done, a lot of traveling, a lot of interviews. Typically, a lot of the interviews were done in prisons because so many of the suspects, so much of the information coming from other folks were actually inmates, freshly inmates. It's it is a spider web of a case, if you know what I mean. It just goes in every direction. Here recently, just in the last, less than a year, we have just about gone back and re-interviewed almost everyone in this case.
So is there any remaining evidence that you feel like might be resubmitted as there are advances in forensic science?
Not in this case that I know about. I've not seen anything that is submittable. When you don't have a good suspect, there's nothing to submit. And there was no evidence, there was no unknown evidence gathered.
There was one possible lead, though, that Renetta covered in her Cold Case Project Spotlight. According to her reporting, quote, witnesses reported seeing a red car leaving Sanders' home that night. No make or model was given, and the same type of vehicle may have been spotted by witnesses in another break-in less than 2 miles from the Sanders' home in a mobile home park on Hayes Drive, end quote. This break-in occurred on July 31st, 3 weeks after LJ was murdered. According to police records, the man who was allegedly involved in that break-in was shot by homeowners the same night in what was ruled a justifiable homicide. Could he have been one of the two men who entered LJ's home? In regard to police files, we only have an incident report on the crime, so we don't have many details. Just that the homeowners were considered to be defending themselves, and that when law enforcement arrived, they found the home in disarray. There were shell casings throughout the front area of the residence, and when they followed a trail of blood outside, they discovered the body of a man. He was lying beside a vacant residence nearby, in the grass. He died of a gunshot wound. We can't know if more than one person was possibly involved at some point in this break-in, but as we mentioned, we do know that a similar red car was reported at the scene. Brooke asked Sheriff Rowland about a possible connection during their interview.
It was a factor in the case, as one of the witnesses thought. I believe it was a small red car near the mailbox, and then it sped off. Several days later, we had a red car involved in another home invasion style robbery, and honestly, not too far from this crime scene. But after much footwork and many interviews, did not feel like there was enough evidence to convict. Did it give us a good suspect? Yes. But proving it, thinking it and saying it's one thing, but proving it in the courtroom is another. Mm-hmm. So, sure, he's a suspect, but at this time, based on what we know now, based on what we had that night, there's not enough evidence for an arrest warrant, in my opinion.
Is there any specific witness information that people might not realize is important? Something like having seen the car that could be helpful in resolving the case?
Well, if I understand your question, sure. But we've not met that person. Mm-hmm. If that neighbor, if that friend saw something that night, we sure would like to talk to him.
For Carolyn, the hours and days after LJ's murder were a blur. She was in shock, worried about his daughters, about her other son, and dealing with her own grief. Carolyn told us how her own mother, who was still recovering from her car wreck injuries from some months before, supported her.
My mother, she was something else. And I can remember the night that Elle got killed, and I was on my way home, because at that time I was living with my mother. And I can remember, and I was on my way home, and I was like, oh, Lord, I got to tell my mother that her oldest grandson was murdered. And it was like about maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when I, made it home. And my sister was with me, my youngest sister. And, we had to come in and wake my mom up and tell her. And that was the first time that I had ever heard my mother cry. And I don't even know if I've, I don't even think I had ever heard or seen my mother cry. So that was hurtful to me. And then I could remember days after that, you know, Mom wanted to be there for me to ease some of my pain, because she had buried a child, her oldest daughter, my sister. She died like in 2001. And so, you know, as bad as she, you know, wanted to take that pain away from me, she knew she couldn't. But she was what I needed her to be.
Though a number of people were interviewed regarding LJ's murder, no true leads developed, at least none that law enforcement has been able to share with reporters or with Carolyn. We haven't heard anyone suggest possible connections to LJ's trial testimony all the way back from 2001, when he went on record about the murders of his friends and his own critical injury. That would be a long time, 9 years, to wait for any kind of reprisal. And no one has clearly drawn a line between the first break-in, weeks before LJ's death, and the second, although a connection there seems much more likely. If someone was, as Carolyn and officials think, after LJ, they could have meant that first break-in to be an actual hit. Carolyn is still waiting. She's always waiting for more information. She was at first in regular contact with the Edgefield Sheriff's Office, but that tapered off as the years went on. She began to reach out to SLED, the state agency, for updates, but they too tell her that there's no movement in LJ's case.
I do know that right now, with SLED, the case is suspended, meaning until some new leads come forward, it's just like at a standstill. It's not closed, but it's just kind of idling until some new information comes forward.
That means that his murder is not being actively investigated within the state agency. Edgefield County Sheriff's Office has, as the sheriff mentioned, conducted further interviews as recently as this past year, but they still need the right person to speak up.
What do you think it would take for the people who have information to come forward?
I honestly do not know, because I feel like they don't care. I feel like because they set out to kill him and they did that, they're done. They don't owe me nothing. They don't owe LJ's brother anything. They don't owe LJ's children anything. And because they don't feel like they owe us anything, they're not going to come forward. So I feel like there's nothing that would make them come forward because they don't care. It's not easy. But I know I cannot allow myself, and I honestly do not even want to, be overcome by, you know, depression and anything that could, you know, put me in a position where I'm not able to be functioning. That is what that keeps me, you know, moving forward, you know, being able to do what I do and just really, really, really relying on my faith and relying on God and Him giving me the strength, because if I didn't have that relationship, there's no way I would be able to sit here and speak with you and share with you, you know, where I am today. You just, I don't know, just kind of look at a situation for what it is. And I know for me, this is the situation that I'm dealt, and I have to learn to live my best life in it. You know, and adjust, even in tragedy, you know, with LJ. Even today, I still cannot believe that my child was murdered. But I do know that he has been murdered. I do know that this case is still unsolved. I do know that the murderer or murderers are still walking the street. I do know at some point, there's going to be justice. And so until that time comes, I have to just keep being Carolyn, keep being effective, keep trusting God, and, you know, believing that He's going to continue to sustain me and keep me when that time comes, you know, and we find out, you know, who took his life and after. Because even, you know, once that person or persons are found, it's still not over. Because I look at it like, if I handle it any other way, what kind of outcome is that going to be for me? What kind of outcome, you know, could that be for LJ's daughter? What kind of outcome, or, you know, how could this affect my family as a whole, you know, my son that is here? And while I'm being strong for myself, I'm being strong for them as well. And I can't just fall into a depression because, you know, somebody viciously murdered my son, or fall into a depression because we don't know who did it. You know, just fall into a depression. That's not going to help. That's not going to help me. It's not going to help his daughters. It's not going to help anyone. So I've decided that where I am in this walk, on this journey, I'm going to be the best that I can be. And just, you know, like this opportunity arose, you know, like with the Cold Case Project, WJBF, I look at it as moving in that direction to bring closure to this case and closure to my family. But yeah. And I can sincerely say that I am good.
There are undoubtedly people in the Augusta metro area, whether in South Carolina or in Georgia, who know what happened to Larry L.J. Sanders on July 10th, 2010. Carolyn Bates knows it. When she goes to stand with and comfort other mothers and to attend the events marking their children's deaths, she thinks about justice for her own son. Her granddaughters are 16 now. They only had their father for 4 years. L.J.'s dear friend and mother of one of his children, Monique Moore, wrote a letter to LJ that she shared with Renetta for the Cold Case Project. And we wanted to share a few lines with you now. She wrote of their daughter and the loss of LJ, quote, "You were robbed of seeing her grow up and become an awesome young lady. She hasn't been able to see your bright smile or enjoy your silly personality. You didn't get to cheer her on at award days, violin concerts, or dance the night away with her at daddy-daughter dances. You won't be there when she walks across the stage for her high school graduation. Those things were stolen from us." If you have any information regarding the murder of LJ Sanders, please call the Edgefield County Sheriff's Office at 803-637-5337 or Midland Crime Stoppers at 1-888-CRIME-SC. Midland Crime Stoppers offers rewards up to $1,000 for tips leading to an arrest. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We also have occasional video live streams and blogs, which all patrons can enjoy starting at $1. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well, so you have an alternative way to contribute. You can sign up now on the app, and you'll begin receiving ad-free and early episodes of the podcast. Our portion of the proceeds will go to the therapy fund. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turner.